Hello and welcome to the Cannon Fodder Podcast. I'm Daniel Barnes, critic at Barge.
Oh.
I live on a barge. I live on a barge. So, Corky, the star of this week's film, La Atalante, is Michelle Simone, who rose to fame largely because of a movie called Beaudou Saved from Drowning, which was remade in the 1980s as Down and Out in Beverly Hills.
No.
But you know who has saved me from drowning? Metaphorically. I'm a very good swimmer. I live on a barge, remember? But you know who's kept me from drowning in my sorrows? You know who's kept me from growing down and out in Beverly D'Angelo? Why did you stop that, by the way? Simone says, it's Corky McDonald.
I was there and I saw what you did. And I remember, don't worry. That song, Phil Collins, In the Air Tonight.
Sure.
There was long a when there
legends,
yeah, like a folk tale, folk legend.
Oh, sure, yeah, like an apocryphal story.
Yeah, that he wrote that because he watched someone drown,
right.
And then
brought
the guy to the concert and sang it with the spotlight on the guy. Like, even as a kid, when I heard that, I was like, "No, he fucking didn't. No, that's
right?
Stupid." Why would...
But you know who did believe
No.
him? Marshall Mathers. Because he repeated that exactly.
Did he work that into a song?
That's so stupid. Oh, classic. Classic stuff. Classic banter, I would say. Did you agree? I agree.
I agree.
With
the bantiest
the
banter.
The bantiest... of the banters. But you know, there is something in the air tonight, Quirky. It's the smell of heroes.
Oh,
true, real heroes. You know, not those fake heroes who are always like, oh, I showed up first to the scene of an accident, I'm so great now.
Those heroes. Those fake heroes, like the ones who watch someone drown. They don't do anything about it. They just watch it, and then they go on to write a song about it, somehow track that person down.
For sure.
Bring them to a concert. And then provide Eminem with musical material. Not those heroes. We're talking about real heroes.
Different heroes.
Those heroes are the ones who donate to our PayPal. And we want to take a moment to thank each and every one of you heroes. Single you out. Put a little bow on your chest. Pin a little thing to your lapel saying, true hero. And tell you how much we appreciate each and everything you do for us. We couldn't do the show without you.
And if you would like to join the League of Heroes, head over to daredaniel.com. Find the menu at the top of the page. Click support the show. Any contribution that you make to this show helps keep it all going. Helps keep the lights on. Helps keep us from drowning and going down and out and living on a barge.
Speaking of barges, tonight's movie is about a barge. We're reviewing La Atalante. The IMDb synopsis for La Atalante. Newly married couple Juliette and a ship captain Jean struggle through marriage as they travel on the La Atalante along with captain's first mate La Pierre Jules and a cabin boy.
Yes, La Atalante, or La Atalante. I don't know how to pronounce it. Whatever. It's just, don't worry about it. It's on a boat. It was directed by the French filmmaker Jean Vigo. It was his only feature. He's a really legendary, kind of not very well-known figure in cinema, mainly because he died at the age of 29. He was a real wunderkind, already making films in his 20s. Died at 29 while working on La Atalante, or actually just after the film was released, leaving behind only a handful of shorts and this, his, like I said, his one feature film. He was the son of a militant anarchist who was murdered in prison when Vigo was just 12.
Jesus.
He was sent to a boarding school under an assumed name because of that. That experience would inform his other major work. That's the 1933 film, Zero for Conduct. And Quirky, if you'll remember during our 400 Blows discussion, I did mention Zero for Conduct because it was a huge influence on 400 Blows. And there is a scene that's that overhead shot of the kids who are following the teacher and peeling off sort of one by one or two by two. That was a shot that he borrowed or was inspired by Zero for Conduct. So a big influence on the 400 Blows, which is in our canon. After Zero for Conduct was banned, Viggo shelved plans for a more political film to make La Adelante, partly because it was a commercial subject. I mean, if you can believe it, movies and songs about so-called barge dwellers were really popular in France at the time. Viggo also got to work with established actors for the first time. As I said, Michel Simon. He was kind of a big name after being in Renoir's Baudou Saved from Drowning. And Dita Parlo made a name for herself in Germany, and this was her return to France. Film took 4 months to shoot. Viggo would act out the scenes for the actors himself and just keep shooting until they got exactly what he wanted, which was really similar to what I've heard about Charlie Chaplin, for example, that Chaplin would just act out the whole thing and be like, now do this, do it exactly like I did it. It was a grueling shoot, too, a lot of location shooting. 1934, remember, at night in very cold weather, wet weather, Viggo had actually contracted tuberculosis 8 years earlier, and the conditions of the shoot profoundly affected his health. But with Gaumont executives breathing down his neck, he just had to keep plugging away and plugging away. So with a rough cut completed and all but a handful of shots in the can, Viggo finally took some time off to recover, but his condition only worsened. Meanwhile, a disastrous preview screening in April 1934 sealed the fate of La Adelante, as Gaumont cut 20 minutes from the film, renamed it, and inserted popular songs. It's like the playbook for like how to ruin a movie has not changed in 100 years. Released in September 1934, it was a failure with critics and audiences alike, and just a month later, Viggo was dead at the age of 29. It's not a stretch in the least to say that this film killed him. Mm. I mean, truly, like he gave his life for this movie to exist. And here we are a century later, the censors and the bean counters, they're all dead and forgotten. And Viggo lives on through the magic of his films. His work was rediscovered after World War II, and La Adelante became a staple of the Sight and Sound Critics polls. First placed in the top 10 in 1962, had its highest showing at number 6 in 1992. That was following a 1990 restoration, so it was kind of top of mind. You see that recency bias a lot sort of through the decades in these polls, that after a major restoration, a movie kind of comes, sort of bubbles back up and moves up this list. It has been kind of slowly sliding downward since then. It placed at number 34 in the 2022 poll. David Thompson, the great film critic, said of La Adelante, quote, "not so much a masterpiece as a definition of cinema, and thus a film that stands resolutely apart from the great body of films." Corky, I watched this film actually earlier today by myself. My wife was busy working, as most people are, you know, in the afternoon of a weekday. Not me.
Not your barge.
What an awesome life. But I was kind of anticipating before I watched it, when it was still like, we might end up watching this together, I might kind of offer it to her. And I was sort of positing it to myself, like, if she asks me, what is this film about? How would I describe that to her? And I really struggled even to myself about how I would describe it. Because I feel like you either would give a one sentence, very short, very vague answer about the sort of like higher ideas of this film, or you would give a very extremely long and detailed answer. And neither of those would make much sense or be very sufficient. So I'm going to ask you, Corky, how would you describe this film? What's it about? How would you describe this one to a noob, as a noob yourself coming in?
Just the story of a couple that gets married and attempts to live on a barge 2 weeks. You know, of life on a boat, cramped quarters, of people trying to live together, and then just exploring where that goes from there. So it's a little bit of Money Pit. It's a little bit of like Bottle Rocket, where it's just like you light it and you see where it goes. Like I could assume that they're like, well, people would fight if they were in close cramped quarters like that. And she's never been out in the world. Okay. Well, they would fight. Okay. What happens when they fight? Okay. One storms off. Okay. You know, like that kind of thing. So there's no like, I don't think there's a deeper meaning aside from what marriage can be like or a relationship can be like. I don't think there's anything deeper than that. And then also like, hey, let's get this fucking camera out here on the River Seine and see what that looks like. let's see Paris at night. You know, let's see what we can capture with this. So
yeah, and turns out it looks pretty friggin' awesome. Yeah,
it's pretty too. Stunning for being almost 100 years old. The things that Viggo was doing that became like how you make movies and the mm-hmm. looks you capture to tell a story.
It's pretty like sophisticated filmmaking for how like often like simple and restrained it is. And remember, he's making this at like the age of 29 too, which is just unbelievable. But yeah, it's a story about marriage, right? It's a story about love. It's a story about kinship, about like being together and things that like bring us together and things that drive us apart. Life on the canal is a really rough, lonely life where the real world seems just sort of a little kind of on the other side of a barrier that you can kind of see through. But I think you kind of hit on something, because like when I think of this movie, I think of like these sort of magical kind of dreamlike qualities of the film. Like, remember, like this is the early 30s. So I'm thinking back to like Vampyr, for example, mm-hmm. which was a movie that like straddles this border of silent movie and sound movie. And this one kind of does as well. It's a sound film. Like there's dialogue, there's songs, there's all this kind of stuff. But it also has like that kind of like alien artifact feel of a silent movie, where it just feels like something kind of magical and different from another era. And yet there is also this like hangout film quality to it as well, right? There's this whole middle section where we're kind of drawn into the rhythm of life on the canal and of being in those close quarters and of the day being the same as the day it was before, and feeling like I'm kind of bored with this husband of mine, even though he's a very handsome looking man. I'm more kind of getting more interested in like this guy, because this guy's actually lived. He's lived beyond the barge. Yeah. He's lived beyond the canals, you know. And it just is like, even though I'm not like attracted to this person anyway, he's not good looking at all. We're talking about Père Jules, the Michel Simon character, who is sort of the secret hero of this film, right? Like, again, like if you were watching this in 1934, you might not think secret hero, because you'd be like, Michel Simon is the known character, Jean Basté, who plays Jean, the barge captain and the husband of Dita Parlo's character. He's not a star. Michel Simon was a star, but like their relationship seems like, you know, the captain, first mate, and the captain's a handsome, young, strong guy, and the first mate is kind of slovenly and goofy and all this kind of stuff. But he does end up being the heart, the soul, and the moral compass of the film, in kind of a almost sort of shocking, you know, twist of fate, because you do not expect that at all when you see Michel Simon's character, Père Jules.
Yeah, he's described in one of the reviews we read as earthy, and I was like, oh my earthy, god, there's no better that's word.
That's a very complimentary way of talking about
it. He's got dirt on him.
Yeah, I mean, there's a scene where he comes home like drunk, like dead drunk, but you get the feeling in most other scenes that he's just like slightly drunk.
He's inebriated.
Like, he's just shy of comatose, but he's still there. He's still with you. He can still do his job, you know? Yeah. And then he goes in a dead drunk, but he still sets an alarm even as a dead drunk, which you got to admire that. But I do think that the opening scenes of this film are absolutely remarkable. This scene coming to the... It's after the wedding. We don't see the wedding.
Don't see the wedding. Just see the walk through the
village. So these
are
the two main characters of the film. And it's just their man and their woman. This has a very like elemental sort of a like... They're living in this kind of idol. They're living in this world that is sort of apart from the world. And as they're walking from the church, as this wedding march from the church to the barge, what I love is like we get her whole backstory
through gossip.
We get everything. Yes, her relation to the village, their relation to her, their thoughts on this interloper. We get a little bit of a slice of his backstory as well. They don't say a word. This couple, who is going to be our hero and our heroine, they don't say a single word. we only get, as you said, these snatches of gossip, and then we see the image of how, as they're marching, they get further and further ahead, and the crowd gets further and further behind. And it's also very noticeable, especially once they all get to shore, and they get on the barge, and everyone else is just sort of like watching after them. I mean, this is a very funereal atmosphere. She's the only one wearing white, which is good at a wedding, but everyone else is wearing black. And
they're so excitedly waving to them as they sail away.
They're
the
waving,
barge.
And they have no reaction at all.
They could not be less giving a shit about watching them sail
watching
away.
Them go. Yeah, and that, like, you know, she never really talks about it or anything like that. But I do feel like that sort of like fuels her. We get a lot about how, like, what a miserable life she is coming from, where life on a barge with this guy, this kind of emotionally distant man, and his slovenly first mate, and a cabin boy who doesn't really talk. That seems romantic.
Yes, right.
Right? But then that informs, like, well, then as she comes into contact with other people, right, as she learns more about Pere-Jules and how worldly he is, well, that seems very romantic. And then when she goes the peddler and this con man and Paris seems so romantic, the peddler seems so romantic, she just, you feel like, wow, she is so innocent. So innocent.
Yeah, you can see, you know, like, once she gets on the boat and she's in the boat for a while, that she didn't think past boat. Like, just being on the boat
didn't
was
think
exciting.
Past escape.
Got me out.
Right?
Yeah. And then,
like, I just had, that was an opportunity to get the fuck out.
Maybe thought,
now we'll, what's the next
the
thing?
The boat goes somewhere besides this, like, you know, 1,000-year civilization on this river. That river has to stink to high heaven, right? And they are barely above the waterline. It's not like they're on a yacht cruising around. They are on a half-submerged, like, monitoring the Merrimack type boat, right? And they got to pull in these docks all the time. They got to stop. And you can see that she's just like, man, these men probably smell real bad. There's cats everywhere, pissing and shitting probably all over the place. Having birth on their marriage bed.
Cats, yes. Yeah.
So she gets a little fed up and realizes this part isn't the romantic part. But I will say, one thing that shocked me about this movie is how horny it is. Like, how horny they got it to be in 1934.
True. The thirst is real. Yeah. I that scene where they come, that first scene on the boat where, as we said, there's that march to the boat. There's that really grim goodbye. They're out on the water. And then she walks to the stern, bow. I don't know which side is the front. Mm-hmm. Whichever side is the front of the boat. She's sitting there. He kind of comes up behind and almost like tackles her, right?
Yeah.
Like, this is like his, this is his seduction
method.
This
is enough privacy. Like,
a Greco-Roman style of seduction.
We're still visible, but we're like 100 yards away.
Right? Absolutely. And then there is just these like stunning shots of her walking back the entire length of the boat. The camera is kind of going with the boat, but then she's going against it. So there's all this like motion that is happening, and yet she's still like staying the same in the frame. Stunning, unforgettable
scenes. I was sitting
there,
I'm like, this is 1934. There's no Steadicam. There's no wires.
Yeah, like, how is this even happening? Yeah, it's unbelievable. And then, again, like, lest you think, okay, well, this is just, she's just calculating. She just sees this guy, Jean, as, like, a means to an end or anything like that. She really does have, like, a feeling for him.
Oh, yeah.
And certainly, like, a desire for him, because as the scene ends with him coming back and being a little more tender and carrying her off to their nuptial bed.
And then it's pretty much just conversation on the boat, about life on the boat, the foibles and the little things that happen. And then in the second half, we kind of escape the boat, but not on like a grand focused adventure. It's just like almost bits that happen. It's events that happen. They go to see a show. They get accosted by a kind of huckster con man. We have almost like a musical number. The captain or the first mate gets drunk. So we're just dealing with life getting off the boat and then coming back to the boat.
Yeah. It all does kind of like tie together, though, right? And I think it kind of gets into this idea of like Jean and Père Jules, of these like two different men. One of them seems like one thing, one seems like the other, but the appearances are not what they seem, right? So Jean is our ostensible hero. He's the captain. He's really good looking, but he's very distant. He's very fragile, and he makes really bad and very selfish decisions as the film goes on. Jules, anything heroic that happens in this movie really is done by Jules, even when it's not really heroic. I'm thinking about the stolen phonograph horn,
yeah,
right? Which he got really for other people, really for her, for, you know, for the captain as well. But that was something where he was thinking, even though it was a drunken crime that he committed, right? Like, it was something to do something for her, do something for other people on the boat, whereas Jean really only does things for himself. So that all ends up, though, like this, the politics that are happening on the boat. Jules goes to like a card, like a tarot card dealer, a fortune teller, right? Yeah. Which prevents the couple from actually going to Paris, which upsets her and kind of leads to her later sneaking off because she wants to see what's going on in Paris. And it also leads to that scene with the peddler. And again, I think we really see like how innocent she is, because she, no one falls for this guy, right?
Yeah.
Like no right. one falls for it. Except for her. And she falls for it, like she falls for it so eagerly because she's so bored. She's so bored with life in a small town, now with life on the barge. Show me something, give me some music, give me some kind of comedy or something. Show me something I've never seen. Be funny. Be anything.
And it's not like she runs away. She gets left. Her husband
the peddler shows up later. And the Jean comes back and kind of kicks him in the butt and says, take off, right? Mm-hmm. So when she leaves, his thought, I think, is that she went with him. All she really wanted to do was look at, like, shop windows, yeah. look at the puppets in the windows, look at the dresses and the lights, and just have an experience that is beyond just this very limited world of the boat. And he is so like torn apart by that he just deserts her. He, I don't know what the Alpine divorce version on a barge is, but that's what
I just heard that term for the first time like 2 days ago. Like,
it's the French Canal divorce.
That's hilarious. Yeah.
But yeah, he just ditches her, and again, like Père Jules. Kind of like, hey, why, you know, just give it a couple days,
yeah,
you know, she'll come back, it's no big deal, and she does. But no, he's done with her, he's done, he's, his fragile male ego can't take it, which again, like the maturity of this film and of being ahead of its time and outside of its time, as David Thompson, that quote that we had, that like this movie like exists outside of like other movies. Like this is not a film, like, yes, this is a film around 100 years ago, but it's also a film that was never even of that time. It's out of time. It's just this like strange, magical world that is created here. Yeah. You want to talk about horny? Boy, the scene where they are pining for each other. So they've been separated, but they're in separate beds. She's sort of like tracking him down, you know, as he's going down the scent. She gets her purse snatched, and she has some other things happen to her, but like she still is like tracking him down. But they have this scene where like they're in separate beds, but you can tell they are just like
they both have vibing on each other,
man. There's also that scene on back on the boat where he's sort of crawling towards the camera, yeah. and you think he's crawling to her, but then he crawls sort of over the camera. I mean, yeah, like you said, it's horny, and there is nudity in this movie too, isn't there? Right, because of the picture.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Room. Yeah. But yeah, it is it's bawdy, as you would expect a French barge movie to be, but also like really. Very mature, very sophisticated, very very sexual, very just thoughtful, and kind of an amazing film, I think. The compositions are just beautiful. The camera movements are perfectly restrained. Underwater shots.
Yes. Like
absolutely extended. Beautiful.
Underwater shots. Mm-hmm. I'm like, how the fuck did he do this?
And, you know, we talked during Night of the Hunter about how Charles Laughton studied silent films and films from this era to kind of inform how he was going to shoot Night of the Hunter. And you have to think, like, he must have watched La Dolente before those underwater shots of the Shelley Winters character. So, I don't know. I think that's about it. That's about as much as we see. Like, again, this isn't like a plot-driven film in any way. Like, it's... there's a film that we're going to deal with eventually, the F.W. Murnau film Sunrise, that I think there's probably some shared DNA here, because again, like, that's a simple film that is just like, there's a man and a woman who are together. The man is tempted by a second woman and returns to the wife, right? And that's like sort of gender reversed version here, right? Like, there's a man and a woman, they're together, she strays a little, she strays a little more, they're apart, and then they're together. And like, again, that's why I'm saying, like, how do you describe the plot of this film? There isn't really a plot. No. You know what I mean? Like, there's just a vibe, there's a feeling to it, there's a sense, there's an emotion, there's a tone, there's a style, and that's why I think it is such an ineffable film, as David Thompson was alluding to in the quote we shared earlier. Also, cats, just cats everywhere. And I love cats, but also don't watch this film if you don't like seeing cats literally thrown at people.
They are like, thrown willy-nilly, and anytime literally thrown. They needed a cat to come into screen, they threw it from off-screen into screen. Just
here's a cat throwing from, like, why are you sideways and upside down? That's like, yeah, that's crazy, crazy stuff. However, I will say, if you can believe it, the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty for Animals supplied these cats. These were like actual French alley cats. This was a step up in their life, most probably.
they probably got fed better than any time before.
They got fed, they got love, and apparently Michel Simon, the cat who was in the phonograph horn, apparently he adopted it, and that became his cat. Yeah, so... and Jean Vigo really did love cats, but there is a lot of throwing of cats in this movie. And when I say throwing, no, I mean throwing. Yeah. Overhand throwing.
This is Steve, like, Martin in the Jerk.
Justin Verlander fucking throwing of cats, okay? Like, fucking the Mahomes is just slinging cats all over the fucking
submarine style.
Serious. He's just going down low, knuckles hitting the dirt on the pitcher's mound. He doesn't care. Cats just flying out of there. So that's the film. That's it. That's La Dolente, directed by Jean Vigo. It is his only film on the Sight and Sound 250, but really it's kind of his only film. Zero for Conduct was...
29 is so goddamn young. That's
rough. It is, yeah. It's very... it is one of those, like, James Dean where you just like, man, what could he have done? Like, what other, like, how, what could he have had, like, a Renoir level career where it just goes through the decades?
Yeah.
Like Buñuel or somebody like that. So, anyway, we lost a lot of films, but we got one really great one, and it's La Adelante. So, Corky, let's wrap this up and give our ratings. I'll just remind everybody, of course, we rate on the Slight or Sound scale. If we both think that it was a sound selection, kaboom, light them up into the cannon fodder cannon. It goes. If one or both of us think it was a little slighted, meh, no cannon for you. But we will put up for a vote a film not in the Sight and Sound 250, a slighted film, if you will, to put in its place. Corky, La Dolente by Jean Vigo, slight or sound?
Yeah, it's sound. It's a sound selection. I wouldn't put it up at number 6 like it debuted, but it is a sound film. The performances are good. It's hard to, you know, for me to look at a 100-year-old film and say what performances are fantastic, you know, unless they really capture me. So the performances are good. There isn't really much of a plot. We just follow it. But I can't really stress enough how good looking it is for a 100-year-old film. I say I can't judge performances, but I can judge, like, just editing of that era and takes and the way the shot is composed. That none of it looks dated. It looks like these could be shots that you do now. Maybe if there's an effect, maybe that's a little dated, but still, underwater shots, on the boat shots, nothing looks like they're rocking on the water and dizzy. The night shots look good, as the golden hour shots look great. It's so well composed and it flows together really beautifully, whether it's day on the side of the River Seine or whether it's night in the city. It's a really great looking movie, and I highly suggest you check it out for the look of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just think it's a profound, beautiful film about love, and does it in a very simple and yet utterly complex sort of way. Complex in its simplicity. And I talked a little bit about the kind of dreamlike quality of the film, and a lot of that comes from, as you were saying, the visuals of it, which have this kind of like hazy crispness to them, you know, like it just has this, everything has this sort of like overlay of like, this is just happening in some sort of a dream state or a fugue state or an imagination, or it's just a little bit of like hyper reality. But there's also this feeling of like reality, like just the real reality of like, here you are on a barge with a filthy man
who's doing a puppet tattoos. Show for you. The most frightening fucking puppet.
Frightening ventriloquist puppet show with you. Yeah, with this like torture device. Super fun. I think it is pretty magical film, and I would absolutely recommend that everyone check it out. So that's a sound. That means two sounds.
Cannons.
That means hey-o.
Roaring.
Into the cannon fodder cannon it goes.
Well, that's what we thought about La Lande. What did you think about it? Did you watch it with us? Had you seen it before? We'd love to hear your take on the film. Leave us a comment on your favorite podcast app or contact us. You can do that on Facebook and Instagram at Dare Daniel Pod. Tell us your thoughts.
All right. Now it's time to select the film we'll review on our next episode in 2 weeks. We're going to hit up the random number generator. Corky, you ready for this?
Yep. Let's go, baby.
Where did you land? You landed on Oh My Bella Tarr. Corky, I've never seen a Bella Tarr film. Are you familiar with Bella Tarr?
Dracula. Frankenstein.
Bela Lugosi. And also not Frankenstein. Good guess, though. Bella Tarr was a Hungarian filmmaker. He actually just passed away. It was in January of this year. I think he was a really big Tarkovsky acolyte, so I think we're heading a little bit back into that world as well. Known for really long shots, like long duration of shots, really complex long shots. And Corky, in 2 weeks, we are going to be reviewing his 2000 film, Werkmeister Harmonies.
I've heard of this.
Werkmeister Harmonies. I will tell you the Letterboxd synopsis of the film. A naive young man witnesses an escalation of violence in his small hometown following the arrival of a mysterious circus attraction. As I said, it's directed by Bela Tarr. If you want to follow along with us, it is available to stream on the Criterion channel. It's also available to rent on all of your usual VOD services. So I'm actually pretty excited about this. Yeah, Bela Tarr is one of those, like, I don't know, white whale. I mean, I hate to be cliche, but I've never seen a Bela Tarr film. Mainly because, like, this one's 139 minutes. That's like a short film for Bela Tarr.
Okay.
He has, like, some 5-6 says. Satan Tango, I think, is 7 hours
Good.
Long. He's got some others that are, like, 5 and 6 hours long. So he's got some real sits. So 139 minutes, perfect introduction to the world of Bela Tarr.
Nobody gives two fucks for Bela. What movie? Name the movie, Dan. Hell yeah. Fucking great movie. We'll see you again in 2 weeks, but until then, follow Dare Daniel Pod on Facebook and Instagram. Like and rate us on your favorite podcast app. If you'd like to donate to the show, visit daredaniel.com. Find Support the Show in the menu and look for the donate button. If you're a fan of new movies, listen to my man Dan here review the top films of the day on Single Take with Daniel Barnes. For Cannon Fodder, I'm Corky McDonald.
And I'm Daniel Barnes, saying until next time, save us a seat in the back row. Bye-bye.